Get on with it, Macca.
Nearly didn't make it. Good morning and welcome to... What are you laughing at, John?
Just the behind-the-scenes chaos and the smooth presentation on air.
Yes, good morning.
I have them away.
Now, look, I was just... I went to put my undies, my Reg Grundies on this morning, as you do, and these are new, like I've worn them once, and I haven't washed them yet. And look what happens to the... They've got an elastic band around the waist, ladies and gentlemen, like quite thick, a couple of centimetres, 3 centimetres or something, is it? And look, you just, look at them. You just fold it and it stays folded. No elasticity. These are made in China and it says here on the inside, and it's not, there's no label on it, it's just sort of stamped on the thing. Cotton elastane, it says. Cotton elastane. Wash before wear. Wash before wear. Mm. Little Chinglish there. Size 4, it says, and they're hull-proof, made in China, designed in Australia. And I have to say, Mr. Hull-proof, I think they're dagging. And this comes in the week when Shane has launched his new line
spinners
line of undies. I don't know what they're called, and that's an ad, John. But these are daggy. Look. See that? These are new underpants, brand new. I bought them in DJ's the other day.
Mm.
And look at them. The elastic band just, it's like it's just, almost. No, sorry, I just threw them at
They weren't meant for you on my head, were they?
No, they're.
That's
they're
a few
like,
years ago now, I used to do
The
that.
Rubber, the elastic's like it's, you know, it's already. Gone, shot.
You don't think it's the waist that could be the problem, not the band?
Well, that's what I mean. No, the band, the waistband, yes.
No, your waist rather than...
Waist's fine, mate. No,
hasn't changed for years.
No. On the program this morning, you'll meet a goanna. what are you laughing at? You will.
I met a possum this morning. I was getting the mailbox out, and there was this possum sitting on the top of the mailboxes.
Yeah, they're native to Australia. So are goannas, but you don't...
normally see them, you know, in shopping centres.
No, not in the cities. I saw a panel beater work his art the other day. I think he's a mate of mine. His name's Glenn. And there was a ding in the back panel of a Holden. And what he does, see, usually what happens when they have a ding, they just fill it up with Nicky and sand it off. But he panel beaded it out. And he's got a little implement where it just draws it out. And I said, why do you do that? He says, because it's a shame to put that sort of stuff in a car if you can do it properly. And he says, it's a nice car. It was a you know, some years old, Holden, probably 5 or 10 years old, but a nice car. And it was all panel beaded out and sanded off. And it's just wonderful to see. I played a song last week called The Jeweler's Art, and the panel beater's art is just the same. To see anybody do anything well, whether they're driving a bus or a panel beater, is just a wonderful, wonderful thing, I believe. Did you know it's lemon season in Australia? I know we import lemons from all over the world.
So it's sort of lemon time.
Yeah, they're picking lemons in Gander at the moment. They're thinning. They're thinning trees, mandarins and probably oranges, because mandarins start when? March.
So is that all citrus?
Mandarins kick it off. They're a bit before oranges, but so picking will start with mandarins, but they're already picking lemons. But I remember when I was in Gander, Mundubbera, year before, and the bloke told me that we import mandarin juice, for God's sake. We throw a lot of mandarins away here because they're not eaten or whatever, but when they're not juiced, but we import the juice. We're going to talk about free trade this morning because it's like a number of opposites or a number of things where the word actually doesn't, it means more. It's not actually free trade. There are strings attached. So we'll talk about that. You'll meet the goanna. We'll talk about blackberries. And I'll talk a little bit about horses.
G'day, Macca. This is a couple of smelly pairs of underpants out in Barry
Miller. It's the boys on Barry Miller. Alex and Pete, we wondered what had happened to you. The last time you were at Kerguelen, and where are you now, mate?
We're about 100 miles from the Southeast Cape, which is the bottom end of Tasmania. It's where we turn left to go north into Hobart. It's pretty wild and woolly out here at the moment. It's gusting 35 to 40 knots, and... we're surfing off the tops of 10-metre waves, so it's quite interesting, isn't it?
Wow. And have you heard the news about the tsunami and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, somebody emailed us about that. That's not going to be a problem for us. I mean, it's going to be a half-metre blip in 10-metre sea, so bugger all.
So you've look, I haven't talked to you, what, for 3 weeks, I think, or 2 or 3 weeks, certainly.
Give me about that, yeah.
And, well, how's it been?
Oh, you know, it's just a long trip. We've had good weather and bad. You know, you just have to headbang your way through it. It's not not been really bad. It's just been difficult occasionally, and we you know, we're nearly home, which is nice. We're rather hoping to find an abandoned dinghy full of Cooper's Sparkling when we get to Recherche Bay, but I don't think it'll happen.
Yeah, Alex. So I greatly admire sailors, but especially you. You've had a pretty rough trip, really, from around Kerguelen, haven't you, and even across from South Africa.
Yeah, it's been pretty bumpy. This is not a very good line, just for your information. So if you lose us, it's probably the satellite connection over.
Uh huh. Okay. No, it sounds all right this end to me. And so what's tell us something interesting you've seen or what you've been doing when you've sailing along. What do you think about?
What do you think about? Well, I mean, we keep a blog going every day, so that's pretty much the baseline of what's happening. I mean, there's you know, sunsets and night sky and albatrosses. I mean, the albatrosses are just magnificent. And if you've never seen one, you haven't lived, I tell you. They're beautiful birds. And, you know, there are lots of different ones, too. I mean, it's just bewildering how many different kinds and sort of different shapes and morphs there are of them.
And they just fly and fly and fly, don't they? And they just glide and minimum fuss.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they ride on the sort of pressure levels off the tops of the waves, and they seem to move at enormous speed without moving their wings. Wonderfully graceful and, you know, totally superior. And they just sort of look at us and say, "You stupid buggers," you know. Anyway, yeah, we should be in Hobart probably late tomorrow, I guess, or early the next day. And we'll park there for 3 or 4 days and slip the boat, clean some of the grot off the bottom and get some of the green hairy bits out of the inside of it, and then come on up to Sydney. Over.
And won't you be glad to touch land, I reckon, even though you are a couple of salty old salts?
Oh, it'd be kind of nice, yeah. But, you know, big anti-climax in a way. I mean, when you actually finish something like this, you know, you sort of look forward to it for, you know, for days and for weeks, and then it happens and it's gone. So there's always a bit of a letdown as well.
Yeah, it's like the end of a show when you do a show or a concert or something, and then you sort of sit backstage and you say, "Well, is that all there is?" Because I suppose it's because of the adrenaline, the excitement, and the pressure and the stress, and then it's all gone.
That's it, exactly it. Yeah. You know, and I mean, right now, I mean, just as I'm speaking, we're surfing off a bloody wave. I can see froth and bubble and crap going past the window at enormous speed, and Pete's holding on with both hands, you know, and he's waiting to talk to you.
We talked to Jane Girling from the Weather Bureau about the speed that tsunamis travel, and I know you said it's not going to worry you when you're surfing 10-metre waves, but she said it travels at the speed of a jet. So the tsunami would...
7 metres an arc.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a pressure wave in the water, and yeah, and it's moving really, really fast, and we might just feel it as a slight bump in flat water, but we won't feel it at all out here. Not in this stuff, ever.
Yeah, all right, Alex. Nice to talk to you. Does Pete want to have a word quick?
Yeah, I'm sure he does. Hang on a sec. Here he is.
Hello.
G'day, Pete.
Okay.
You're almost home. Home is the sailor from home from the sea and the hunter home from the hill or something like that.
Hunter home from the hill. Yes. Yeah, it's going to be good to be home. It's I especially miss... I suppose my family more than anything, and you know, just waiting to get back to see them and hear what they've been doing.
Well, they know what you've been
kids.
Yeah, they know what you've been doing. You've been you've been sailing, and it sounds like it's pretty rough out there, mate.
Yeah, yeah, we're expecting it to come from the south, and we're all rigged up. So you know, expecting a southerly of about 40 knots, and it ended up coming more out of the northwest. You know, we had to sort of change all the sail settings and things like that once it hit. Anyway, yeah, we're sort of snug down now. We've only got a little bit of one head sail out. And it's on the end of a pole, so it's not flogging or anything like that with the various changes of wind you get when you take off from a wave and when you get down into the trough.
Wow.
You haven't got the pressure of the wind on it anymore, and the sails start to flap and crash and that. Anyway.
It's scary. I admire you two, but I also admire your little yacht. And you were telling me it was built in the 60s by that bloke in Melbourne. It must be a tough little customer, your Barry Miller.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's, it was built in a time, Macca, when they were just moving from wood to fiberglass, and they hadn't really established, I suppose, you know, how strong fiberglass was and how long it would last. It was a new material, and they basically built it to the same specifications what they would in wood. So, you know, the fiberglass is pretty much as thick as the wood would have been in a lot of places. Not in the hull, but it's strengthened with stringers and ribs in the same way that a wooden boat would be. Whereas now they've learned how to, you know, save money by, you know, petroleum has cost more, and certainly fiberglass resin has cost a lot more. And
so you're saying your boats
are much lighter.
Yeah. So the Barry Miller is fiberglass.
The Barry Miller's fiberglass. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, early fiberglass built, and you know that's the reason it's sort of so heavy and strong.
A tough little 10-metre boat, which is only small to be out in those. It's as long as the waves that you've got out there, mate.
Yeah, well, you know, it's built to stay upright. It's got 2.5 ton of lead, which is situated, its draft is 6 feet, and most of that lead is in about the last, say, foot on the keel. And, you know, it's a solid boat, but the thing is, like, when Alex went through the Northwest Passage, the boat hasn't really been reinforced anyway for, you know, a trip like that where you're likely, you know, you could be ice bound going through new ice, you know, you're breaking through, it's like sheets of glass in the water. You know, the ice is only, it's sort of frozen overnight, and it's about, you know, a quarter of an inch thick or something like that. And breaking through that, apparently, you know, if you're in a fiberglass boat, it actually rips the boat open along the waterline, whereas ice is continually breaking into the side of the hull.
Uh-huh.
But Alex managed to get through without any of that nonsense.
Pete, I better fly, but great to talk to you. I look forward to meeting you when you get on dry land again, and you better come in the studio and have a talk to us, both of you. It'd be great.
Okay, then. Thanks a lot for chatting with us, Macca.
Good on you, Pete. Say goodbye to Alex. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Can you imagine? We've talked in the last couple of weeks, but for a while we've talked about free trade and what it means. And I'm not sure we all or any of us understand really what free trade is. It's a word that's bandied around, and the devil is in the detail of free trade. So I've got a bloke in who might be able to explain to you what in fact it is and what it means. When I was at school, we always got essays in economics, and they said, state the advantages and disadvantages of dot, dot, dot. So I thought Dr. Stuart Rosewarne, who's in our studio this morning. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning.
He's with the Faculty of Political Economy, Faculty of Arts, Department of Political Economy, sorry, Faculty of Arts at Sydney University. How long have we been talking about free trade?
Oh, a couple of hundred years now. First put to us by Adam Smith in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations, and then developed much more systematically by a guy called David Ricardo in the 1820s.
What does actually free trade mean? Because to most of us, free means free. But I know, for instance, there are quotas on, say, beef exports of ours to America, and we've got some sort of free trade deal with them. But there's devil in the detail, isn't there?
That's right. Look, it's a really simple concept that's extraordinarily complicated, because it starts from the assumption that we're all on a level playing field, we're all playing according to the same rules, we're all delivering the same quality sort of product, all working under the same economic regime, there's lots of competition in the marketplace, so everybody's facing each other on equal terms.
Which is not right.
Well, it's not right at all. You know,
we're dealing with economies like China, although we haven't got a free trade deal with them, but we're working on it, aren't we? I read something about Simon Crean the other day sort of touting up how good it would be for us.
Exactly, yeah. It's been under negotiation for some time now.
So what does free trade mean then? When you're a little guy like us, dealing with a big guy like America, we end up with a short straw, I would suspect.
Generally speaking, that's the case, yes. In the case of America, we've got an economy that preaches free trade, or a country that preaches free trade, and has a whole lot of regulatory restrictions in place that limit the exercise of free trade.
Especially with regard to agriculture, isn't it?
Most certainly with regard to agriculture.
Because they're the
right
people...
right across the spectrum of the primary industry...
And they're the
in
people,
the United States.
Because the middle America, if you like, are the people who vote in presidents and
that's
people
right.
like that, aren't they?
That's right, yes.
When people talk about the advantages of free trade are what?
The supposed advantages of free trade gives each country the opportunity to focus on what it's best at producing. And if we concentrate on what we're best at producing, we'll be able to put that good or product onto the marketplace at a relatively cheap price. And in return, we'll be able to buy goods from other countries that are being produced much more cheaply than they would be in, say, Australia.
So we're writing an essay here. Now, the disadvantages. What are the disadvantages, especially for small players?
Well, the disadvantages is that you face an international market. And in the case of agricultural products, this was a particular problem in the 1950s and 1960s, where you had a lot of developing countries, and we can throw Australia into that picture as well, were competing against one another and were driving the price of the product down. They were all producing goods at a low price, and they were all producing goods that were relatively low value, whereas some of the advanced industrial economies of the world, such as Europe, England, and the United States, were producing manufactured goods, which had a lot of skilled labour component in them. They were high value added, so they would be selling those products at a much higher price in the marketplace.
It's pretty hard for people. I mean, I had trouble understanding economics, but for instance, everywhere I drive, and I drive around Australia, I see cattle in paddocks, and yet we're importing beef from America. I mean, I just can't understand that, but there must be a reason for it. I don't know, but there must be.
Well, it goes back to the question of a level playing field. We don't have completely free access to the American market. The beef that we can sell in the American market is at the bottom end of the market. It's used to make hamburgers and things like that. It's not the quality product that we, say, export to Japan or Korea, whereas the United States has relatively free access to the Australian market.
And it's costing us jobs, I suppose. I mean, there's a social consequence to all this as well as an economic consequence, isn't there?
It will certainly cost us a lot of jobs. And I think it's also worthwhile looking at the bigger picture, not only in terms of Australia-American beef trade, but the implications of us allowing American beef into Australia has broader implications, because it lowers some of the barriers to the United States' capacity to export beef into Korea and Japan, where we're the biggest beef supplier.
We've talked here about the free trade agreement between New Zealand and China, which means we're getting a lot of goods in here which are marked product of New Zealand, when in fact they come from China. So lax labelling laws, along with so-called free trade agreements, I mean, we don't know where anything's coming from, and we don't know what we're eating, really.
Exactly, and I think that's one of the other issues that really needs to be addressed, the question of quality. Under Australia's trading regulations, we would ban the import of any beef that had the risk of...
BSE.
BSE. Mm. Under the American regime, they don't have a BSE-free category. They have a low-risk category. And so the beef that we'll be importing from the United States
is low risk.
Is low risk. It's not BSE. It's not necessarily BSE free. If you look at the whole character of the American beef industry, it's dominated by factory production. There are four major companies that dominate beef processing in the United States, and they continue with some of the practices that gave rise to BSE.
You're pretty brave, aren't you? Because I talk about the free trade mantra. Everybody talks, it's a bit like motherhood, apple pie and stuff. Everybody's got to talk free trade. If you don't talk that, you're a cave dweller or something, a Neanderthal or something like that. I suspect in Australia, certainly, there's a bit more information about it. And it seems to me, with the current furore, if you like, about the BSE and the beef coming in, that will only grow, because people are starting to realise that it's not free trade, it's anything but.
That's exactly right. There will be a lot of fuss made about it, but the problem that we're going to face is that we have very little room to move under the Australia-US Free Trade Agreement. When that was negotiated, it was negotiated largely on terms that were defined by the Americans, and we were patsies.
Are they like contracts? Can you rescind them, or can you just ask for them to be renegotiated?
You can renegotiate them, but you're always behind the eight ball.
Who's going to be brave enough to do that with a big... yes, David and Goliath, isn't it?
Exactly.
Stuart, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
Tell me, what do you do on Sunday mornings?
Sunday mornings I'll be going for a cycle and a swim.
Fitness. It's when you say cycle and swim, what, 500 metres or 5 miles? Are you a big swimmer?
I'm not a big swimmer, but I'll go for a decent ride. But it means that I don't get to listen to you anymore.
Oh, we can see you can listen on the net now at any at any other time. And university starts this week, doesn't it?
University starts on Monday, yes. Mm. Yes, looking forward to that.
Not if you had students like me, you wouldn't be.
I'm not sure about that.
Dr. Stuart Roseman, lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
Cheers.
Yeah, it's Russell here, matey.
Hello, Russell.
Russell from Murrumburra. Yeah, I've had experience with free trade deals. You know, I have reservations about things, but yeah, I do manufacture equipment for the abattoir industry, but there a few years ago, I was on the Burrumong meat processors payroll. I manufactured sinks and sterilised the units.
Mm.
Then a few years later there, after they had a fire, they needed 40 of the things, and I quoted, I want the job price of $1,000 a set, and they flew a sample on a pallet to China with the city relationship I got going and got them out for $300.
And so you lost out?
Yeah, I lost out, yeah.
Hmm.
So they got given the good old Aussie local intellectual property and did a nice backdoor deal.
I see. Yeah. So, Russell, you're in Murrumburra. That's in New South Wales, isn't it?
Yeah, hard Murrumburra, railway town and a pretty prime agricultural area.
So what do you do? Are you still involved in manufacturing, Russell?
Yeah. I have a crack at doing a bit of work for the food industry. I did a work for Sydney there this week, what I call drought-proof work, non-bush work.
Yeah.
And I manufacture a nice industrial press, and I sell about one of them a year. But it's pretty tough competing with the imports. Like, these politicians, Johnny Howard and Paul Keating, reckon these free trade deals are real sweet. But it's great if you're eyeing the iron ore wagon or the coal truck. But if you're a manufacturer getting played off one-on-one against an Asian wage rate, she's a bit of a FU Jack deal.
Yes, and so what happened? They sent one of your little sterilising units over to China and they copied it and sent it back per a third of the price. Is that the story?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah,
and you get paid anything for it?
No, nothing.
Wow.
So I do, buying on meat processors, I've just gone into receivership. And these days when I work for them, I work for a bit extra. So I thought to myself, well, they're having a shot at me, so I'll have a shot at them.
I know there was we had a call a couple of weeks ago from because they were concerned about there'd been an abattoir closed up. Where was it? Kalkalani as well. I think there's been three closed. And this is about beef coming into Australia. And so they had a bit of a meeting there yesterday up in Ireland. I don't know. We'll try and get a result from that.
Yeah.
Russell, good luck. Is it still hard to compete?
I've got some loyal customers here in the bush, and there's some people who have been very good to me and have some good working relationships here and there. And, of course, we need a bit of rain. It's raining here now as I talk. It just started, so that gives a bit of confidence to the bush. But you don't give up. You've got to be a loyal soldier to the Australian cause, and don't give up when they're getting these dodgy deals done to you.
Russell, I love you. I love you, and I love the way you talk. Good on you, mate, and good luck, and keep in touch.
Okay, thanks, Mac. I love your show, mate.
Bye. I'm talking to Gary Criddle. He's a 767 pilot with Qantas. But your passion, Gary, is?
The Cessna A37 Dragonfly, which is a Vietnam-era jet, a ground attack jet. That's my passion.
What? How come?
Well, some years ago, I fell in love with it and couldn't live without it. At the expense of a wife, bought a jet.
I won't comment. So tell me, you were in Vietnam?
Yes, but that was in my early naval career, and I was a midshipman on a destroyer on the gun line in those days. And some years after Vietnam finished, I was trained by the Navy as a pilot. Flew off the aircraft carrier, and...
How exciting.
Oh, it was great fun, but I was young and stupid then, and it didn't hurt. However, these days, I guess for the last 20-odd years, I've been with Qantas.
And you like to be around planes other than your Qantas planes. When you're not working, you're around planes.
Yes, I'm on leave for another few days, and being a member of the Historic Aircraft Restoration Society, you just can't stay away when there's a big weekend.
What's it like being... You fly international?
Yes. The 767... used to be exclusively in international aircraft. However, for the last 10 or 15 years, I guess it's been doing more and more domestic. I still get occasionally as far as Honolulu or Tokyo, but most time, if you fly the city flyer, you'll see me between Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane.
And you flew us once when we went to New Zealand about, what was that, four years ago?
I guess it would be. And it was quite funny. A week or so later, you were broadcasting and I was sound asleep. And my phone rang and it was my dear elderly uncle milking the cows in Wonthaggi. And he said, "Macca's talking about Gaz." I think you were impressed by my... relax, you're in safe hands here on board the Spirit of Australia.
Something like that. It's always nice, I think, as a passenger, the sound the sound of the pilot is just as important as how he handles it, I reckon.
Yeah, it's an indicator of whether he's awake or not.
Or he's got the wheels down.
Oh, yes, that's always a good one. Oh, no, it wasn't me. When I make my announcement on board a Qantas aircraft as the captain, it's traditional to mention one's name. But for the last 15 or 16 years, I've not done that. I've left it to the customer service manager to do that. And there was a very good reason for that. When one makes a mistake, it usually happens, hopefully, when you're younger. But I was a very junior co-pilot, and I was the captain insisted that I address the passengers. So I did. And I said, "Hello, this is your first officer speaking. My name's Gary Criddle, and today we're flying from Cairns to Singapore, da-da-da-da-da." Only I pressed the wrong button on the radio transmit panel, and I've transmitted this beautiful four-minute public address to everyone that was listening on the airwaves. And, of course, after that, 20 aeroplanes came back and said, "Thanks, Gaz."
"Thanks, Gaz."
"That's really good. I always wanted to know that, Gaz. So now I don't mention my name anymore."
So tell me about Vietnam... planes. What planes flew in Vietnam?
Well, this particular aeroplane that I own was a ground attack jet, which started life in the US Air Force. And then it was a 1969 model. So in the early 70s, right towards the end of the war, the Americans gave it to the South Vietnamese Air Force. It only flew for about 300 hours, saw a little bit of combat. But I'm thankful to say that it was then put in a container and lost behind a hangar for about 25 years.
And you bought it?
Well, the late Colin Pay and a gentleman by the name of Noel Vinson imported seven of them. Of those, one is now flying in New Zealand. Mine is the only one in private hands here in Australia. Colin Pay's estate still have one, but it's not yet flying. And, of course, David Lowy down at Tamora Aviation Museum has about three. But this aeroplane climbs extremely steeply. If we were getting airborne here, in less than 200 metres, we'd be climbing at near vertical.
Wow.
Yes,
wow.
It's fabulous. Mm.
Your love of planes continues. You don't...
Always. Mm. Or love aeroplanes almost as much as women.
I'll leave it at that. Gary Criddle, great to talk to you.
Live dangerously. I can't die young anymore. I'm getting old. Thanks, Macca.
Good on you. I'm talking to Dallas Young. He's from Sale. He's part of the Roulettes. You've heard of the Roulettes. The ground crew. People that keep him in the air. How are you, Dallas?
Oh, I'm very well. Thank you. Yourself?
Good. Pretty busy job. You travel around with them too, do you?
Yeah, wherever they go, we go. We always provide ground support for the aircraft, so... Yeah, we travel every second weekend generally to all different parts of the country.
Yeah, all over the place, I suppose.
Yeah, a lot of places. I've seen a lot of places I'd never seen before, and that was the exact reason I joined the Air Force, to see a bit of the country, and I've certainly done that with this position.
Yeah. So, and that's the plane over there, that little red thing, red and white?
That's the first, yeah. There'll be another six coming in about an hour's time. There's six in the team. We always take seven away. We have a spare aircraft on the ground should something happen that we can't rectify. Yeah. There's always seven, yeah. So that's the commentator. He does our sort of ground PR stuff.
So they travel. Yeah. So they travel in those planes.
Yes, they do.
And you hitch a lift in those, do you?
No, we travel generally by road. We have a trailer full of spares and replenishment stuff and anything we need's in that trailer.
You're like a roadie, in ACDC.
Pretty much, yeah. So generally, say for this trip, for instance, the boys left this morning. We've been on the road since yesterday morning, and they'll get back home tomorrow afternoon, and we'll be home Monday. So we're sort of a day behind them. Leave a day before, get where we've got to go, get things set up, and yeah.
So what's your training, Dallas?
My background's avionics, so I joined the Air Force just over 15 years ago. So I came in to do structural stuff originally, but was lucky enough to sort of not do that. Ended up with the electronic side of things. So anything on the aircraft that's run by electrics, pretty much we work on. So.
Which is most things, isn't it, I suppose?
Not so much on this aircraft. On our more advanced aircraft, like the jets and things like that, very much so. But on this PC-9 aircraft, which is used in the roulette, it's quite a basic aircraft. So there's a bit of avionics, but it's a very reliable aircraft. So, yeah, they're quite good to work on.
Now, you live in Sale?
I do, yes.
Mm. And that's where you're from? You're born and bred there?
No, I'm from up a town called Austinville, northern New South Wales. But bounced around a bit with the Air Force, had some time in Brisbane, 10 years in Newcastle, and this posting took me to Sale, so I'll be there for another year or two. Probably been there for 2 years now.
And then what'll you do, you reckon?
Well, it's sort of just depends on the Air Force, really. More than likely back to Newcastle to work on one of the jet aircraft we have up there. But, yeah, it's in the sort of lap of the gods, really. You can put your preferences in as to where you want to go, but end of the day, it's just where they need you is where you go, so...
Yeah, because you always think about the Air Force, the pilots, but of course you've got to keep planes, and that's even more important, really, isn't it?
Well, there's more ground crew in the Air Force than there is pilots, yeah.
So you've got the display here, and then where are you off to?
They'll display here, then they're off to Melbourne in the afternoon. There's actually an Air Force pageant down there, so they display there. And they have another display back in the hometown of Sale for a festival that's on there. Then next weekend we're quiet, and then we're away to the things we do every year. We're across to Adelaide for the V8, the Clipsal 500, then into Melbourne for the Formula One, and then we're actually travelling to Perth for the Red Bull Air Race. We're over there to do some displays there as well, so quite a busy time of the year for us this time.
So let me get this straight. It's from Albion Park here down to what, Point Cook?
Yep.
And then back to Sale all in one day?
Yep, three displays I'll do. So full display here, full display in Point Cook, another full display in Sale. So big day for the boys. They'll strap in about 10 in the morning and won't get out of the seat until about 5 tomorrow afternoon, so... Big day for them.
And you'll be on the road again?
Yep, back to Canberra tomorrow night and into Sale on Monday, yeah. So we'll be here until they leave tomorrow. After the display here, we'll get them ready for their next two shows, so we'll replenish all their smoke or make sure the aircraft are serviceable to go, and we'll send them on their way, and they'll go and do their other two shows and arrive back in Sale, and we'll be on the road back, yeah.
Dallas, great to meet you.
Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for having a chat.
Hello, Michael. This is Louisa here.
Hello, Louisa.
In Geelong, but we went to Dalesford yesterday to pick some blackberries.
Oh, did you?
And it was great. It's the best year for, what, probably 4 or 5 years now.
Really?
Yes.
Great year for blackberries. And they're considered noxious, and I suppose they spray them everywhere, but they're
not
they're just...
there.
Not there?
No. Around Lake Jubilee.
And how do you have to pay to go and pick them, or...?
No way.
You'll have to tell me. I'll come down with me billies and my planks of wood and...
Yeah, and bring... No, no, bring some secateurs. I've learned a new art.
What do you well tell us? What do you mean you've learned a new art?
You bring some secateurs and a big bucket, and you just pick the blackberries, like the vines off, the bits and pieces where the blackberries are. And then you just pick them at home.
Oh, I see. You pick the stalks off and then take them home.
Yeah.
And it's the best year for 5 years, you reckon?
And it's basically you prune them at the same time, so they're coming up better next year.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So what do you make with your blackberries?
I made blackberry jam, 10 jars.
10 jars, wow. Isn't I can remember the feeling as a kid when we walked home. We had about 7 or 8 billies and mum and my uncle and my sister, and we had all these blackberries, and we'd spent a whole day.
Yes.
Hello, the church bells.
Yes, we did it in Holland as well, yes.
That's the church bells there. Are you going to church?
No, no, that's my clock.
Oh, that's your clock.
I thought I switched it off, but it didn't.
Well, Louisa, thanks for letting us know that you said blackberry picking is still alive and well.
Yes, and it's doing really well this year. Good on you, Macca.
Good on you, Louisa.
Bye.
Bye.